For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Thank you. Morning, everybody. I will ask your patience a little bit for this talk because I have a fairly clear idea of some of the things I want to say, but I haven't quite worked out how the parts fit together, except for in broad strokes. So if I fumble a little bit, please give me a moment and maybe I'll recover. The Lankavatara Sutra says, things are not as they appear. And then it immediately adds, but neither are they otherwise. Things are not as they appear, but neither are they otherwise. So I think this is one of those really rich kinds of statements that we find in the Mahayana literature, and it's almost one way could think about it. It's almost a description of the totality of our practice, and there are many kinds of variants of this sort of statement or combination of statements, which give us really no ground, no place to stand. So, for example, many of you will be familiar with this. Suzuki Roshi, in a similar vein, says, you are perfect as you are. And he means it. And then he adds, but you could use some work. So we find ourselves in this position where we are at one and the same time invited to be because we're told that we need some work, and in our hearts we know we need some work, maybe a lot of work. In a statement like this from Suzuki Roshi, we are at the same time invited to maintain a critical and skeptical and humble approach to how we regard how we are carrying out our commitment to the Buddha way. And at the same time, together with that humility and that skepticism, we are asked to totally trust ourselves. You know, so there's this kind of, again, where does that leave us? It either leaves us totally free or totally boxed in or both or neither. We can't quite, this is not the kind of thing we can wrap our heads around, although it's the kind of thing that we can do in our zazen. We can take these kinds of situations in, this kind of ungraspability, finally, of things. So this morning I want to talk a little bit about, I guess in some sense, I'm really just talking about my own practice as it is at the moment, but I'm going to try to do in such a way that can, I hope, will maybe be of use to others and encourage them in their own practice, and at the same time not make it so specific or unduly revelatory about myself in a way that wouldn't be helpful, that kind of thing. I'd like to start out by reflecting for a moment on an experience I had in the White Mountains in Vermont some years ago. with a friend of mine, the appropriately named Yasan, which means fields and mountains. He's been living in the Cambridge Zen Center for a long time, and he's kind of my main hiking, camping buddy over the years. And we were in the White Mountains, and we came to this place where it was quite steep. I mean, we're not talking, I've never done any kind of technical climbing, but we're gaining altitude on a fairly steep route, and it was raining, I remember. We were cold. And we had a place we were going, but very soon, for me anyway, the simple act of finding a place to place my hand, to place my other hand, to place my foot, to place my other foot, to lift myself, and then do that again, was totally engrossing. There wasn't time, or the situation was not conducive to having a lot of other thoughts. While we sort of ostensibly had a destination, there was someplace we were going. The situation called for just a kind of very focused presence, without anything else, really. And the nature of that presence, the nature of putting your hand on one rock and then another and lifting yourself, was such that there was no room to, as soon as you, as appropriately as possible, carried out one of these actions, you just had to let it go, because anything else would interfere with the important task of the next step. So it became a kind of a training in a kind of, well, both presence and focus, attention, letting go. And we see in that kind of a situation something that probably sounds familiar to yourself, this continual non-grasping, this fluidity, is something that we oftentimes work towards or discover in Zazen, right? We take breath after breath. And I think, so far as it goes, it's kind of an apt analogy. There's another situation, thing I would like to reflect on. Years ago, I was a bicycle messenger in Seattle, and the nature of the job was such that the only way to make any money at it was to be very fast. So you had this constraint of speed, and I was really good at it, actually, in those days. And it was similar to this thing in the mountains, because when you are riding fast in heavy traffic, you need to pay attention. You can't, you can't be hanging on in any way to the last situation. So there's this presence, that is constantly. You have to stay totally awake, totally relaxed, and totally non-grasping. And both these kinds of the experience that I'm talking there again is there's a similarity to Zazen in the sense that it's an exercise, it's the practice, it's the cultivation of a certain kind of ungrasping mind. And in fact, they both have these qualities too of there's a way, at least I find in my Zazen, that my, presence to the situation of, for example, this morning being this room with all of you, cultivates cultivates that non-holding on, and sort of, I don't know, we could say maybe that muscle gets strengthened. And that non-holding on is this kind of, as I said, a kind of a non-grasping. So it's very much this presence, but at the same time, you know, that focus and attention has this quality of also opening up the world very widely, opening up your heart very widely, we could say. And so there's, again, this kind of paradoxical quality where these two seemingly antithetical things are together. So, and I think there's a parallel, you know, we talk about the relationship of, you know, the non-duality of practice and realization. There's an analogy there, too. You know, in a way, climbing up a hill, my attention's, like, very limited. And at the same time, you know, even though we ostensibly were going here or there, you know, the fundamental goal is being realized. You know, we are in the mountains, and this is what being in the mountains looks like in this moment, this very careful attention to detail. So it's simultaneously very broad and very narrow. Same thing in the traffic, bicycling, but there was this other dimension in that situation, and that had to do with, you know, you're constantly getting, you know, you have a radio and you're constantly being fed information about, you know, well, you've got to do this and you've got to do this. And so there's, you know, while you're staying very focused, you're also sort of taking a look at this bigger picture where you're trying to get, you know, well, how do I most effectively get from point A to point D, you know, and include B and C, and, you know, there's that kind of consideration, and the consideration also of, well, what are the needs I'm trying to satisfy here? I mean, is somebody waiting at a medical office for important information? You know, are the lawyers freaking out at the meeting because they need a document? So it kind of starts to open up into this bigger sphere, in a way. Now, I guess all of this we could talk about as a kind of mindfulness. And as I'm sure most of you are aware, Zazen is not about mindfulness, but it's not fundamentally about mindfulness, in my view. And one way to think about that is because, and this, well, one way to think about this is because there's this other broader context. And we talk about that in the Buddha Dharma in different ways, but sometimes we say, yes, there's samadhi, but then there's also sila or discipline, ethics, and there's wisdom. And of course, these things are part of our zazen as we sit on our cushions. But we could also look at it in a way that the wisdom and the shila, in some ways, are not just on our cushion, and in some ways they're more about what we're doing in the world, right? And so Taigen, for example, often talks about the expression of our zazen in the world. Suzuki Roshi says, there's this wonderful passage about, you know, sun rising in the east or west, the bodhisattva, you know, the always moves in the same direction. He describes this railroad track, and so you get the sense of, like, the sort of described thing. And that's true in a certain sense, but then he blows it wide open at the end of the paragraph. So, and he says that the bodhisattva way, how does he put it? Something along the lines of the bodhisattva way is to express one's nature and express one's sincerity. And putting these two things together, you know, I mean, so when we're talking about being out in the world and expressing our nature, whatever that might be, and our sincerity, you know, we start to branch into the realm of, for example, the precepts, as not a map exactly, not rules for how to find our way through this radically unstable, ungraspable world. And one of the most sort of unstable and most ungraspable aspects of the world as we experience are our relationships with other people and to the world in general. And this is it, you know, so things like the precepts exist for us not as, as I say, a roadmap, but as a help, as guidance. It's not a narrow track. They're there to help us express our sincerity and our nature. And I think, you know, what Suzuki Roshi is thinking about when he says to express our nature and to express our sincerity, I think he's talking about kind of, what, I don't know, what you'd say, the Buddha heart or something. This thing that we share with all beings that doesn't in any way occlude or obliterate all our limitations, our foibles, our human failings, any of that stuff. But it expresses the other side of that, which is, you know, this kind of Buddha heart, this heart of compassion, and this heart of wisdom or insight, and help us to find a way to express that freely and openly and so on. I've been thinking a lot about the precepts lately, and I talk a lot about the precepts in my talks, I realize. And I realize that I've probably, when I talk about this, left out a very important part of why I bring it up, not just because it's sort of generically part of my practice or your practice, but because this is a domain in which I struggle. If I've ever given, you know, the impression of being kind of preachy, you know, precepts, and, you know, in relation to Zazen, I apologize, because the reason I'm thinking about it is because this is always, for me, seems to be the edge of my practice. I have difficulty with the precepts. We all do. We all transgress in various ways, sometimes completely unconsciously, sometimes unwillingly, unknowingly, or whatever, and other times not. And without going into details, I've recently had an experience in my life where, at least on the face of it, you know, if the precepts were some kind of golden rule, it would be easy for me to feel that I had broken one of the grave precepts, quite knowingly. So I find myself, with regard to that, in this moment of stepping back to what I said before, both having to be pretty skeptical and sort of humble about, you know, my evaluation of my capacity to act compassionately and wisely in the world, on the one hand, and on the other hand, having to trust that this came out of sort of sincere expression of my nature and my sincerity, my practice. And so there's this moment, this element of, again, ungraspability, undecidability, and, you know, maybe that becomes clearer, maybe it doesn't. In the meanwhile, I just have to, as we say, sit with it somewhat uncomfortably. I would say very productively, because the situation has brought to awareness all kinds of things, I think, that I need to be attending to in my practice. So what I will share a little more explicitly with you is a current situation in my life. Many of you have very patiently listened to me over the last years as I have been somewhat freaked out about the situation of my mother, who, you know, I won't go into detail, but she's been dying, shall we say, for a long time, and with a lot of suffering, all kinds of anxieties and difficulties consequent to that situation for, you know, the people who love her, et cetera, et cetera. We are now at a point, it's not quite, there's been no decision made, but contrary to what we had previously thought, it turns out that my mother could be considered, she lives in California, and she could be considered for as being able to exercise what they call the death with dignity law, which in effect is a kind of euthanasia. We thought that she might not be. We hadn't pursued it before, inquired before, because of considerations. You know, people are ruled out of that on mental health grounds, and her mental health is very hard to pin down. She's clearly depressed and extremely delusional, I mean, in a profound way, most of the time. And, you know, and even though my sister and I have power of medical power of attorney, it seems that in a situation, and she's expressed herself very clearly prior to her illness and then in occasional moments of lucidity, how her feelings about this, nonetheless, it seemed like in the moment, for such a thing like this, we would need her to say, yes, this is what I want to do. So this was posed to her a couple of days ago, and she's had a moment of lucidity and said, I want to consider it. So she's considering it. She may choose it, she may not. I think she will. In that situation, the procedure is to take, you know, the medical profession wants a good deal of distance to this, so you wind up with like 200 Seconal capsules that you have to then break down, and then you put them in juice or something, and then the person has to pick it up and drink it themselves. You can't. And I suspect that in the moment, if it develops in this way, that the person who would, for example, do this business of the drugs, et cetera, would be me. And I think that, you know, I think that I maybe will be in a position to do it with a less troubled heart than others. But, you know, on the face of it, you know, this is illegal in 47 states, in most of the countries of the world. And the reason is because it's considered killing. You know, one of the grave precepts is that bodhisattva does not kill. So this is a situation where, again, when I consider my role, possible role in this, it seems appropriate to be skeptical and humble about my own wisdom, and at the same time that it calls for me to trust myself up to and including, you know, doing something that many people in this room would consider a severe, you know, very serious violation of the precepts. So where I am with this now is that, okay, if this is what's called for, I will do this. If this is a violation of the precepts, I will do that. If there are karmic consequences of that for me, for others, I will take those on. This, you know, so again we have this moment, I have to both be skeptical and humble, and at the same time, it's one of those situations where nobody here, you know, nobody anywhere can say, I don't think. So there's also this situation of trust and willingness to assume karma. And I see this as consistent, you know, whether we make mistakes all the time, right? But I see this as, in this situation, as being the best way to express the heart of the Buddha, you know, express some kind of wisdom, express some kind of compassion. And if I've got it radically wrong, well, so be it. So I guess what this comes to is that you know, in the situation of things are not as they are, or things are not as they appear. Well, okay. So, despite what some people might think, you could say, well, this is not murder. This is not killing in the way that the precepts speak to. And of course, on the same times, they are not otherwise. Of course it is. You know, so between those two things, there's really no place to stand. And one just has to trust, right? And be responsible to whatever consequences follow willingly. And, you know, so of course this kind of a situation could be enormously sad. But I think what I've come to is that this is something that I can do, could do, if asked to, with a completely open heart. But it is, you know, it was interesting. Michael Mukaku Zimmerman was here, was talking about the precepts, and, you know, he said, well, and I totally agree with him. You know, he said, we have these things like do not kill. And he says, but most of us aren't in that situation, right? So that kind of a precept is about sort of constructing your life, living your life, developing the frames of mind, the habits, et cetera, et cetera. So were you to be in that situation, you would not kill. You would act appropriately. So in other words, it's this kind of situation that most of us won't actually experience directly, but it helps us sort out all these sort of lesser dilemmas we find ourselves in. But here I am, to my surprise, I actually am in that situation. And, you know, I don't, you know, and so I sort of shared with you how I should, you know, should this play out in the way expected, you know, how I feel about it. I don't need to repeat that. But, you know, we're all in this situation always, right? This is Suzuki Roshi again. You're perfect as you are. But you need some work. There are always shadows. Things are as they are. Or, you know, things are not as they appear, but they are not otherwise either. And just to, you know, kind of seal it up or whatever. Again, it comes to this point. You know, this issue of ungraspability. And you know, some of you who've studied the paramitas and so on know that this idea of we talk about tolerance or patience. This is one of the in some of the literature. This is said to be, you know, it's at this point where a bodhisattva, you know, where it's most called for. It's the most demanding form is of toleration, is being tolerant, being patient, with being open to this ineradicable ungraspability, which is, you know, just it's just a function of you know, these. It's a function of emptiness. It's a function of impermanence. It's a function of non-self. And so, even though sometimes things sort of come to a bit of a focal point, as in this situation for me now, basically we're all dealing with that at every moment. And as I said, we start with that. We start with this sort of letting go moment after moment, this opening the hand of thought, as Uchiyama Roshi would say, on our mats and cushions. But to think that it's, you know, as it's been said many times here, to think that Zazen is restricted to your mat and cushion is a serious, serious mistake about what our practice can be. And this is a mistake of, you know, a lot of, you know, sort of, you know, the mindfulness movement, some other forms of practice, we could say. You know, it's not about that, but it's not fundamentally about kind of relaxing and getting our groove on. It's about living it out in the world, and that's can be uncomfortable. And so I just want to bring that to your attention, and you know, I will just assert you are actually living that moment to moment, and so I would invite you as much as possible to pay attention to that and be aware of it moment to moment. And you're not always going to like it. And I guess I'll just stop there. Thanks.
Thank you so much for sharing with us. It's so important. Great matter of life and death. Please, comments, responses, questions, feel free.
I mean, this is that, you know, we are encouraged, right, by the sutras, by practice and so on, that that these things can, you know, the way you phrase it, the universal in particular, can come together. But for most of us, most of the time, our experience is that there's always something a little askew, at least a little askew, a little off. And that's what the Buddha calls dukkha. That's this pervasive quality of you know, the sense that we can't quite get it right. Nonetheless, here we are, and it calls upon us to live our lives.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes we, I think Mogapu said it nicely too, you practice like anything, especially in those moments, and then you act, and then, you know, maybe it calls to mind the need for forgiving ourselves continuously, for this is, and I don't know how to bring those two things together more perfectly. But there is doing the best we can, and forgiving ourselves and forgiving. forgiving others.
Absolutely. I mean, this forgiving thing is a really important point. And I think part of what happens in practice, or at least has happened in my practice, is that, you know, yes, you are absolutely right that, you know, we can't get things to sort of line up. We can't sort of get everything sort of set and we're done, right? But there can be the development of this sort of, I don't know what you call it, faith, trust, you know, Zhao Zhou, who, you know, one of the very, very great early Chinese masters, you know, said, and I've been thinking about it in this context, that I do not take refuge in clarity, right? So what do we take refuge in? Take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
You know, so we can look at the maybe thing that we're doing wrong, and we can also look at that in the context of what we're also hoping to get right, which is ending suffering. So I just wanted to offer you support.
Thank you. Accepted.
Dana? I work with the elderly, so you're dealing with this quite a bit. I work with the elderly. So I see what your last piece of your talk was about quite a bit. And I had a thought that, you know, if one of the precepts is to not help, but then isn't preventing the release from suffering precipitating a kind of death in and of itself?
Yeah, that's certainly one way. I mean, the, you know, we have these precepts, but the precepts are folded into this bigger picture of, you know, the reason Buddhas appear in the world is to end suffering. It's, you know, so, yeah, we have a responsibility to end suffering.
Joanne.
Your talk was just a great reminder to me about how messy life is.
Notice that, yeah.
And we're stuck with being human right now, so it's messy. And one of the tools that I embrace is that all things are for learning. Or enjoyable, but it is what it is, so that's the way it goes. And it's all rich and wonderful in some way as well. So there are always these conundrums.
Yeah, I think.
Contemplate on them forever.
Yeah, we can, and you know. You know, sort of contemplating, if by that we're talking about thinking things through, very quickly that kind of becomes a hindrance, right? Because it can't be sorted out that way. But what can happen, this thing you're talking about, is treating things as they come up as an opportunity to learn, is what we talk about, I think, in the Bodhisattva vow, right? Which is to, as situations come up, you know, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. So in other words, these things, you know, come up and we need to overcome I need to overcome my strongly entrenched aversion to stepping through those gates, right? And to, without grasping mind, without gaining mind, step through. That happens too. That's what teachers can help with. Jane.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you also, like I shouldn't, for your courage for talking about that. One thing, this is a minor thing that doesn't have anything to do with the struggles you're having, that's hard for my practice is the distinction between the body and the mind. In the first two examples that you gave, you know, you're rock climbing, you're physically moving, and the bicycle, you're physically going, and then it creates a certain sort of alertness and awakeness. And, but this, what makes zazen hard for me is you're sitting there, you know? And
yeah.
So it's like, that's what I, and my personal thing, that's the thing that I have trouble with.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, maybe I didn't... Yes, we all struggle with that. And maybe one of the things that I didn't make particularly clear is the idea that, you know, so developing those kind of qualities in zazen is not the totality of what it means to practice. It's an essential part of practice. And by extension, that means, you know, we need to find ways to bring whatever sort of stillness, whatever kind of ungrasping mind we can access into those, you know, the messy situations, right, that Joanne was just talking about, the messy situations we have as human beings, among other human beings.
The thing about it is not, how can you make your mind ungrasping when your body is totally grasping, but when it's sitting in zazen? That's a contradiction right there, to me.
Well, I know that people exercise a variety of what, I don't know, tools or techniques in practice here. You know, for me, that's when, for example, physical discomfort comes, you know, rather than dwelling with my physical uncomfort and rather than trying to find a way to dodge it, simply returning to awareness of breath and posture. And then almost immediately returning to whatever is bugging me and then just doing that again. And our suppleness or capacity maybe grows. But, you know, these things will always be problems for us in zazen. I can't see you. Let's go this way.
During your talk, for some reason for me, it kept bringing up this idea of compassion in regards to the suffering. And it kind of got into my mind the compassion for others, but also the compassion for self.
Yes.
And I noticed in my daily life, it's sometimes easier to be compassionate towards others and more difficult to be compassionate towards yourself. So I thought I would just throw that out there. Kind of reminded me of the situation that you're in regards to that, because a lot of people, they go through these things, they're filled with heavy parts.
Yeah.
It's difficult to deal with. But I think half of the battle, if you will, with the karmic consequences is the compassion for yourself. So it's kind of, regardless of whether or not you're compassionate for yourself, there might still be consequences, but if you're not compassionate for yourself, it will certainly make the situation worse for yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, this idea of, you know, compassion for oneself versus compassion for others, and Asian's sort of observation that we need to be able to forgive ourselves and to forgive others. It sort of suggests, you know, what the source of our, you know, another expression of dukkha that I referred to is, you know, we need to, and our practice helps us sort of undo, get some distance from the idea that self is here and other is over there. Realize that, you know, we're into this together, always. And, even that's a little distorting. I could say, you know, I won't go there. But, I mean, it's just like, you know, this self and other thing is that, and usually expressed as this inaccurate perception about what the nature of personhood, what the nature of selfhood is at the source of our problems. We think we're separate. And practice helps us under sort of ventilate, at least, if not undo, that idea.
I wanted to say a little bit about the precepts. You talked about the precept about not killing. And, you know, you also spoke about transgression. But part of how we fully observe the precept is to honor the complexity of it. So it's not just not killing. It's helping others not to kill. It's supporting life, including the quality of life. What is, you know, when does life begin? When does life end? How do we see the complexity of that? So these the precepts are questions to wrestle with, and your talk was a wonderful expression of the wrestling with it. They're not rules like thou shalt not.
Yeah.
There's so many levels of it. You know, how do we support not killing the biosphere, not killing humanity? I just got back from Thursday night from being in the Bay Area, where there's still the pollution from all the fires, and there's so many refugees and all of the things that are happening all over the world in terms of climate breakdown.